I want to ask you, kind of think back. Has anyone here ever had the chance to go back and visit their childhood home, visit the neighborhood that they grew up in? Just anyone had the chance to do that? Yeah. So I grew up in Canton, Michigan, just west of Detroit, and I lived at 43081 Devon Lane in Canton, Michigan. I still remember it. You know, I still remember my address. I remember my old home phone number. Like it was yesterday, but, you know, there's this odd thing that happens when you go back and visit your old neighborhood, you visit your old home as an adult. I don't know if anyone's experienced this before, but everything is feels a lot smaller, right? Like, you go back and the distances between places are a lot shorter. I went to visit my old elementary school. This is during the summer, so I just walked around the campus, and it was just tiny. Like, it just felt like this small little place. You know, and I just remember even like the woods in my backyard. You guys see the top circle there? That's Danny Nellis. That's how I grew up, Danny Nellis. And there's that woods in the backyard. And you see that little L shape over to the right? That wasn't even there when I was a kid, right? So that's grown, you know, in the decades since I moved out. But that little, you know, vertical line of woods, it felt like a forest to me. It felt like this huge, you know, unending forest. And now I look at it on a map and I'm like, well, it's only like two houses wide and four houses, maybe five houses deep, you know. And when I went to visit it, I was like completely underwhelmed, you know. I was almost like a little disappointed and at how that, just how small everything looked. And I have some landmarks down there because I wanted you to get a sense of, you know, sort of my life when I was growing up. You know, I had a group of friends that I hung out with. And they were sort of the folks that I as kids I would spend most of my time with. There's Pat and John Anthony down in the bottom left-hand corner, and they were really interesting because their dad worked for the FBI, which made them really like cool to me. Lou Manolius, kind of right down there, he was my Greek friend, always good for a wiffle ball game. There's Chris Cole, who's actually, now that I look back, he was fairly unremarkable, but he was part of the group. I don't remember anything about him. I mean, other than the fact that he was sort of the wisecracking kid in the group, right? And we'll get back to Freddie Owen in a second there. So I spent my childhood playing with these guys along with my twin brother David. And one of the things that we spent most of our time doing was we would play what we called war, right? So as young boys, we played war. And that there were two different variations of war that we did. One was we would go into the woods with buckets and we would collect piles of acorns. And then we would climb up into the trees, and we would just chuck them at each other. So we would just pelt each other with acorns, and that was one variation of war. And the second one, which was a little bit more fun, and I think we did this one because of the aunt, Pat and John, because of their dad. They were, like, really into this stuff. But we played what we called spy, right? And it was like this counterintelligence game where we would just skulk about the neighborhood, you know, spying on the enemy, you know? We had this enemy that we were always on the lookout for, this unnamed, unseen enemy, and we were, you know, kind of just going around and hiding in the neighborhoods with walkie-talkies and just trying not to be seen, and then we would report back to our home base, which was Pat and John's basement. And I was usually the kid that was relegated to guard duty, which meant that I didn't get to go out into the neighborhood. I was in their basement, sitting at a desk at the base of the stairs, just kind of with a walkie-talkie, like kind of taking in all of their intelligence. And usually it was just such a boring thing that I spent most of my time reading G.I. Joe comics. I just have this memory. So I talk about these enemies. You know, we had these make-believe enemies growing up, and it's really easy to, you know, call them make-believe, but you got to remember this is in the like late 70s, early 80s. We were just in the thralls of the Cold War, and so it was easy for us as kids to think that we were, you know, that we were at war, our enemy was the Soviets, or that it was the East Germans, or what have you. But there was actually one very tangible enemy that we had, and that was Freddie Owen. And I feel bad. You guys are going to think I'm a horrible person, but Freddie Owen, he was the enemy. And I'm telling you, like, Freddie is probably right now, he's like the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. He's probably, you know, he's probably really made something great of himself. But he was this kind of awkward, freckled-faced, redheaded kid, and he wanted, and I love awkward, freckled, redheaded kids, but he wanted to be a part of things, and for some reason, he wasn't a part of our group, and I don't say this to brag, but, you know, he was sort of like the enemy, and we just kind of didn't let him into our group. I have this memory of us in the woods once in our group. We built a fort, and we said we don't want anyone to come into our fort without penalty. And so when we were away, we put up this silly tripwire, you know? Like, we didn't think anyone would actually do it, you know? Like, it was very obvious. There's this string across the basin. Anyone who would fall in, we had, like, these pricker bushes. And so, like, the next day, Freddie Owen and his mom come to my front door, and he's covered in these red welts and marks and scratches and stuff like that. And they're like, did you do this? And I'm like, no, I don't know what you're talking about, you know? And, you know, but I, you know, just... It was, okay, I was a horrible person. So if you don't like that, please just hang in there, okay? So, you know, even at a young age, as children, we knew who our friends were, we knew who our enemies were. I knew who my friends were, and I knew who my enemies were, and I knew how quickly you can go from one to the other. Very quickly, we could go from friends to enemies. And, you know, we're in the middle of a series. We're talking through Luke chapter 6, which is called, we've got it titled here, The Sermon on the Mount. Probably more appropriately titled The Sermon on the Plain, because compared to Matthew chapter 5 through 7, which is sort of the sister passage where Jesus is up on the mountain and people are coming and he's talking to them, in this accounting, Jesus comes down from the mountain to a flat place, to a plain, and he speaks to the people. And the title of our series is Upside Down Kingdom, because this is really Jesus' statement about what it means to be a disciple, to be a follower of his. And he's going to say, you know, following me, it's hard. It's a radical call to live life here and now. A couple weeks ago, Tom talked about the call to discipleship, the call to come in from the crowd, to join the ranks of those who follow Jesus into a life marked by obedience. And then last week, we talked about, you know, the fact that being a disciple of Christ means that you have a radical perspective on life, that being a follower of Jesus, it should affect how we think. And that was, it was hard. It's hard to, like, soak that in. I walked away from that, like, really, like, deeply in thought about, like, what is it that I believe? What are the things that I value, right? What are those foundational core things that define who I am? Because if I'm a disciple, a follower of Christ, it should have an impact on those things. Today, we're gonna kind of kick off sort of the next part of Jesus' sermon where he talks about how becoming his follower should radically affect our behaviors. It affects how we act out in the world. And Jesus jumps right into the deep end. He goes right into the heart of probably one of the toughest things that we have as human beings to navigate, and that's relationships. And he's not going to talk about relationships that we have with our friends, because honestly, that would just be way too easy. He goes in and he wants to talk and get to the core of the relationships that we have with people that don't really like us, with people that we may not even like. And so we're going to talk about that here. We're in Luke chapter 6, and we're going to be going through verses 27 through 36. Okay? So if you have your Bibles or your iPads, actually, you know, I don't even know, do people bring their Bibles as much to church anymore? I actually brought mine up here, so you have the authority of having the book up here. We spend so much time on my phone now. So we're going to go through, and we're just going to go through this verse by verse, and I just want you to just think about where do you fit into this. Think about the disciples. Jesus has just gotten through going through the Beatitudes, the blessings and the woes. And I can just imagine if I'm a disciple, if I'm a follower of Christ, and I'm waiting for that next shoe to drop, right? And Jesus doesn't waste any time. He said, you know, he begins verse 27 with the word but, right? So this is, he's transitioning now. He said, you know, woe to you, blessing to you. And now he's gonna get in, and if I'm a disciple, it's like, okay, here he comes. But, and he says, I say to you who hear. And he says, okay, I'm there. I'm hearing you, Jesus. I'm listening to you. I'm listening to you right now. I'll just say that without getting, you know, too much into the language and stuff, but the word for hear here, it's not just to hear with your ears. It actually connotes someone who hears and actively obeys, someone who hears and does. So he's saying, I'm saying to you who are one of my disciples. Remember Tom talked about the crowd and the disciples and then, you know, his apostles. He's talking to his disciples here, those who hear and obey. And Jesus says, but I say to you who hear, love. So if I'm a disciple and I hear Jesus say that, I'm like, I'm all in, right? Jesus is like, go out, I want you to love, right? Easy enough, I can love. Well, I'm just going to say that, and the word that Jesus uses here is a word that's common in Christianity. He uses the word agape. So if you guys have been around here long enough, we talk about the differences in the word love in the New Testament, that Jesus isn't talking about eros. He's not talking about sensual love or emotional love. He's not talking about phileo love, which is where we get Philadelphia. He's not talking about like brotherly love. He's talking about agape love, which is unconditional love. It's a choice to love somebody, to have a genuine concern for someone's well-being, even if they don't deserve it, even if they don't deserve it or reciprocate it. It's that kind of love that Jesus wants us to have for one another. So if I'm a follower of Christ, I'm thinking, okay, like, I can do that. Like, I can love. I can love my friends. I can love the people that are easy to love. And I just hit something here. There we go. And then he says, I want you to love your enemies. And if I'm one of Jesus' followers, if I'm a disciple and I'm hearing that, I'm like, excuse me? Like, I'm supposed to love my enemies? The word enemy here is exthros, which comes from the word exthos, which actually means it's hatred. It conveys the idea of an irreconcilable, deep-rooted enmity. It's to love somebody from whom you can only expect harm or danger. And Jesus says, I want my followers to choose to unconditionally love these people, people who you would consider your enemy. And then he doubles down on it, and he says, I want you to, just so I'm clear, just so that there's no mistake, I want you to do good to those who hate you. When he says do good, he uses what's called the present imperative, which is like present meaning now, and an imperative is a command. So he's saying, I want you to constantly have an attitude of doing good. When he says do good, it's not like it's a one-off thing. I don't want you just to do a good thing. I want you to constantly be doing good to those who have a deep-seated hostility towards you, right? And I hear that, and I think, wow, like, it makes me have a couple questions. I naturally have a couple questions when Jesus gives a command like this. I think, well, it's a very general thing to say, like, to love my enemies. And we could just close our Bibles right now, and I could say, okay, everyone, go out and love your enemies, right? And you say, okay, let's go love our enemies. And you'd be like, we walk out, and we're like, I need something a little more tangible. And Jesus, I think he understands that because he's going to help explain what he means in the following verses. But, you know, I have a couple of natural questions that come up when someone, you know, when I hear this passage. And my first question is, well, who are my enemies? Like, I think I try to personalize it. I look at my own life, and I say, who are the people that I would consider to be my enemies? And then really, what does it practically mean to love them? What does it mean to love my enemies? And Jesus is going to help us answer that question. I want to just sort of tee this up and sort of bring us from like how we tend to view people, how we tend to view what we call our enemies. And I'm going to kind of take it from the general to the very specific. There was a survey that was done by YouGov back in early 2017. They pulled over 7,000 people, and they were asking who do Americans consider to be their greatest enemies? And I would just say, if you look at that list, and you can't tell, there's color coding that shows like strength of, you know, who you see your enemy is. But if you look at the list to the left, and you kind of go down that list, you'd say, yeah, I think that probably makes sense, right? You'd say who are the people that are probably the greatest threat to our country, either, you know, economically, politically. Who's got nuclear powers that they might want to use against us? Who are the people within those countries that might harbor terrorism? And we consider them our enemies, right? And so I look at that list and I wasn't surprised. Now you can take this list with a grain of salt because what they don't show is that 1% of respondents feel that Switzerland is our enemy. And I can only say like. Why? You know, like, who has a problem with the Swiss? Would anyone here say that they're part of the 1% that has a problem with the Swiss, right? So, but intuitively, we look at that list, and it's really easy for us as Americans to project out and say that there's whole countries of people that we consider to be the enemies of our country. Does that resonate a little bit with you? Probably not hard to imagine even in our current political climate. But, you know, let's bring that in a little bit because, you know, we tend as people to also look at general populations of people groups, and we might consider them, depending on your politics or where you stand on certain social issues or whatever, you might consider certain people to be your enemies. For example, you might consider immigrants to be your enemies, maybe activists to be your enemies. The people that are part of organized religion, you could consider them to be your enemy, or people that are a part of the government. You might say, yeah, I'm no friend of the government, right? You might consider people who are obnoxious sports fans to be your enemy, right? Anyone know any of those? Right? You might be or obnoxious fans of that show that you just don't really care for, or that you don't even really know anything about. Now, if I'm losing you on that, okay, just start praying, okay? Right? Now, these are general groups of people, right? But let's make it a little bit more specific to your day-to-day life, right? So let's talk about the people in your life that slow you down, right? You know who I'm talking about? People that go through that checkout line with 30 items and they're only supposed to have 20, right? Or how about people that cut you off, right? I'm going to tell you that okay, I'll just tell you honestly, he doesn't have his finger up. He's going like this. I just put the circle there for effect, but okay, just to take the mystery out of it. But I'll tell you, when I'm driving, like this is the one that hits home for me. I will start my day, and I'll just be like, I love you, Jesus, I love you, Jesus. And then someone cuts me off, and I'm this guy, right? How about the people in your life that exercise direct authority over you? Maybe the people that exercise authority over you at work, or at school, or at home, right? It's easy to laugh, but these are very real examples of people that you could consider your enemy. I'm just going to go, let's just cut right to it. That if we are really honest with ourselves, that and how we feel, that even our neighbor could be considered our enemy, right? Like the people that we encounter because they got the loud dog, or they play the music, or they park their car wherever they park it or whatever, they become your enemy for some reason, right? So it's really easy for us to we can put a face to it. Right? It's not some abstraction. Jesus, when he's talking here, he's not talking about an abstraction. He's not talking about a general thing. He's talking about very real people that we should be applying this to. And he's going to do so in the following verses. So you want an example of what it looks like to love your enemy? Jesus is going to talk about it. He's going to say in verse 28 that you should bless those who curse you and pray for those who abuse you. He's got a couple of complimentary statements here. So to curse, you hear the word curse and you think, like to curse somebody. It is the attempt, the word here, it means the attempt to bring evil, harm, or injury upon someone by means of a statement. So to use your words to try to bring harm to somebody. And to abuse someone means to mistreat or display a spiteful spirit towards someone. To threaten somebody, to insult somebody, or to falsely accuse or treat someone spitefully. So, has anyone ever had this happen to them? Where you've had someone at work, your parents, at school, where someone that you might even consider a friend, maybe not, but they've done this to you. They've cursed you in some way. They've treated you poorly with their words. I'm just going to say, I talked about the driving thing. This one, of the examples that Jesus gives about, our enemies and what defines an enemy, this is the one that hits the closest home to me. If anyone knows me closely, they know that, my words are what I use. They're the weapon of my warfare, right? That I can cut them down with my words because I'm so darn smart, right? I'm clever, right? And I've always got the right response. So when somebody comes at me with their words and they want to get into a verbal duel, they're like people coming to a gunfight with a knife, right? Because I'm ready. I'm ready to cut them down. And even not just getting into verbal battles, but even just my use of sarcasm, my wit sometimes get away from me. I still have this memory of being in school. I went to college out in Cedarville, and I had this close friend, her name was Cindy, and we were just hanging out, and we were talking, and she was, sharing something really deep about a friend in her life, and I knew this person, and I didn't really care for this person, and just offhanded, I just made some kind of cutting remark about this person, and it just came natural to me, right, to do that, And all of a sudden, I wasn't even paying attention. I looked at Cindy, and tears were rolling down her face. And I'm like, what's going on? And we had this really hard conversation about my words, about how what I said really cut her. You know, it cut her because it was cutting somebody else, and just the insensitivity of it all. You know, Jesus, I think Jesus talks about words first because I think he knows what dwells inside of our hearts and what comes out very quickly can come out of our mouths. James talks about it, you know. When he talks about the tongue, he talks about how hard it is for us to control our tongues. He said that no human being can tame the tongue, that it's a restless evil full of deadly poison. Think about that. With it, we bless our Lord and Father, and with it, we curse people. That word curse, who are made in the likeness of God. And from the same mouth comes blessing and cursing. My brothers and sisters, these things ought not to be so. So I think it's all the more telling that, you know, that when Jesus talks about this, he talks about people who cut us down. When you're attacked verbally, that the natural thing, it's natural. We say this, right? It's like, it just comes naturally. We want to just give it right back to them. And Jesus says, no. He says, when you are cursed, bless. So we get the word bless here, it's where we get the word eulogy from, right? It means to grant or acknowledge power to somebody. You want to grant them power. You want to grant them success. So when cursed, we want to wish that person success. And when somebody verbally abuses us or verbally mistreats us, Jesus wants us to pray for them. And you say, how? How is that possible? Back to college, I had this friend, Josh, and he really wanted to work on his language. He really wanted to work on, like, his first response when things happen in his life. And I remember thinking, I got to take a drink here, sorry. I remember him saying how it was just such a godly response that he wanted to have, and it was almost funny, but he was trying to condition himself so that any time something bad happened to him, that his first response would be the word blessed. Went to a Baptist school, so he's just like, oh, blessed, right? So, but we were kind of like joking with him, like, well, what happens if you're like hammering a nail and you accidentally hammer your thumb? You know, are you going to start? And he said, no, I want to say, instead of like hammering my thumb and saying, oh, blankety blank, I'd say, oh, blessed. You know, I thought that was like just a radical, almost like too far kind of thing in my mind. But I think that Josh was onto something. I really do. I think that this is such a hard thing for us with our tongues, with our mouths, that to be able to like condition yourself so that your first response when attacked is to turn it around and wish a blessing on someone. I think it speaks, it's evidence of the supernatural nature of the response, that it's not something that we can just generate within ourselves. It's something that has to come from within, from Christ in our lives. And I think it's very easy to see this exampled in the life of Christ, right? When Christ was on the cross, right? And they're hurling insults at him. I mean, his response was to pray for those people who were persecuting him. You look at Stephen, in the book of Acts, when Stephen was being stoned, and he's like, Father, forgive them. Forgive these people. He's praying for his persecutors. I want to have that in my life, right? But I can't do it myself. I need the supernatural working of God in my heart to be able to do that. So Jesus is going to move. He's going to move from our people who abuse us with their words to people who attack us physically and materially in verses 29 and 30. So he says, I'm going to just read through the whole thing here. He says, that to the one who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from the one who takes away your cloak, don't withhold your tunic either. Give to everyone who begs from you. And from the one who takes away your goods, do not demand them back. So Jesus, let's talk about the first one where he says, to the one who strikes you on the cheek. There's in the book of Matthew, the parallel passage here, Jesus actually talks about, you know, if someone strikes you on the right cheek, then give them the left. And here he doesn't do that. And there's sort of, you know, within scholarship, there's a question about, you know, if whether when Jesus is talking here about being struck in the cheek, whether he's talking about a backhanded slap. Because to hit someone in the right hand, well, I shouldn't do that. To hit someone on the right-hand side of their face, you wouldn't naturally, you would be a left-handed person, right? And naturally, if you're going to hit someone on the right-hand side of your cheek, it's going to be more of a backhanded slap. Does that make sense? And in that culture, to be slapped with a backhanded slap would be considered a great insult, right? So there's a thought that this striking on the cheek is more considered like a backhanded slap insult. You guys following with me so far? You get that from Matthew. But Luke doesn't do that. He just talks about being struck on the cheek, and the word for cheek here is actually the same word for jaw. So really, I mean, he could be talking about someone clocking you in the face, clocking you in the jaw. It doesn't really matter, but I think it's important just to know that, you know, that they, I think they both apply, right? They're both considered grievous insults to somebody. Now, at this point, and I really racked my brain for this. I was trying to find like a great personal example of striking someone in the face or being struck in the face. But I don't have one because, I mean, just look at me. I'm not a fighter, you know. I'm a runner, right? So now I've been threatened before, but I've always been able to, I've told you before, the first part here was my words. I was always able to kind of talk my way out of a fight. Except with my brother, because we had to live together, and I got some wounds there. But like, I don't have stories of all like the bar fights that I've been in, or defending someone's honor or whatever. I'm not a pugilist, right? So I don't have an example of that. But we're going to talk about what Jesus is. What does he mean here when he's talking about? But before we do, I'm just going to go right to the heart of something that I've really been thinking about. And you might think, well, I wouldn't think of it that way, but I want to just speak to something about this part where he says, if you are struck in the cheek, turn the other cheek. That the one thing this passage is not saying, I want to be clear, is that if you're in an abusive relationship, that this gives permission for you to stay in an abusive relationship, right? So if you just turn the other cheek. There are folks that will just take a plain reading of this text, and because of their own twist of Scripture, that they'll say, that this gives permission for people to just sort of stay and be beaten up. I don't know if anyone here ever even thought of that, but it's actually a reason that people use. They actually use Scripture in that way. And Jesus, to take Scripture and to try to do something like that would actually take away from the broader point that Jesus is making here. And the broader point that Jesus is making here is when struck, don't retaliate. And it goes right with the previous verse. When you're struck by someone's words, don't retaliate. And if you're struck with someone's fists, don't retaliate. You know, our immediate response to physical confrontation, it's fight or flight, right? And when you're threatened physically, the immediate desire for self-protection, it's natural. But to choose not to respond to a physical threat like this, with someone in your face pushing you around, causing you physical threat, is honestly to bear the mark of Christ. And I'm going to just give you what I think is a pretty remarkable example of this, that Christ in John 18, you know, he's on trial, and he's got his accusers all around him, and Jesus, he speaks up and gives a defense of himself. And when he had said these things in John 18, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand and said, "Is that how you answer the high priest?" And Jesus answered him and said, if what I said is wrong, bear witness about what is wrong. But if what I said is right, why do you strike me? Now think about this. You're the creator of the world, right? And you have power over all of creation. You have power over the angels to come to your rescue. You certainly have the ability to defend yourself here. And Jesus, he did something pretty remarkable. He made a point of pointing out the injustice, right? He pointed back to them and said, Why are you doing this? Where is the justice in this? And this goes back to the heart of God, that God is a God of justice, right? But Jesus did not retaliate. And for us, going to get into murky water here, but you know, for us to not like strike back physically is actually to bear the mark of Christ. He goes on and he says, you know, that to the one who takes away your cloak, don't withhold your tunic. Now, again, this is kind of like, well, there's a cultural thing going on here. So folks in these days, they had an outer garment that they called their cloak, and the inner garment, which might be more like a shirt, would be called their tunic. In Matthew, it's interesting that they actually reverse these. And in Matthew, he makes a point of, like, it's as if someone is suing you. He says, if someone sues you for your tunic, then give them your cloak. And in here, he says, if someone takes your coat, takes your cloak, then give them your tunic as well. So I think the context here isn't so much someone suing you, it's more someone forcibly taking your coat away from you. Now, in this culture, to have your coat taken from you, your outer garment, your outer coat, would be a pretty serious thing. The outer cloak that these folks wore, it generally, they only had one, and it kept them warm. It kept them warm at night as a blanket. So in order, if someone were to take your cloak away, someone took your coat away, you would be exposed. You'd be completely exposed physically to the elements and to the world. And Jesus says, if someone takes your this outer garment, this outer protection, then don't just let them have that, but let them have your shirt. And I think it speaks to, again, Jesus is using colorful language here. He's going above and beyond to say, you know, if someone is in your face, don't retaliate. If someone is taking something from you, don't try to reclaim it. And by telling them not to to do these things, he actually goes into verse 30, and he kind of doubles down on his remark, and he says, to give to everyone who begs from you, and from everyone who takes away your goods, do not demand them back. And he tells his disciples, he wants them to refuse to demand that which would genuinely be for the good of another person, even if it's at their own expense. So you've got the picture of here, someone, you know, being physically threatened, having their stuff taken from them, and even when someone comes and asks for something from you, that you shouldn't deny them of these things. These are hard things for us to soak in. He wants us to be willing and ready to sacrifice what we have for the welfare of others. I've got a friend, Leslie, at work, and she and I were just talking this week, and we were having a meeting over at Grant Medical Center, which is right in downtown Columbus, and she was talking about how she was going and grabbing breakfast in the cafeteria, and there was this gentleman who had he looked like he was a homeless guy, and he had a thing of a bowl of oatmeal, and he had a thing of orange juice, and he was walking, and he tripped right in front of her and spilled everything out, right? And Leslie's just standing there, and she starts kind of helping him clean it up, and then he said, I guess you saw that, and she's like, yeah, and he goes, she said, would you like me to, you know, buy you another, whatever. And and this guy, he got like a thing of pancakes and a bunch of eggs, and right. And Leslie, bless her heart, like she gave. She did not withhold. You know, it would have been the easy thing for her to say, hey, wait a second, you know, like I'll cover you for oatmeal and OJ, you know. I know Leslie. I know that she's a follower of Christ, and I don't know if she would attribute her actions to you know, the higher call of Jesus to be a disciple, but she made a point to not withhold what was probably within her right. You know, we'd say it's within her right to withhold that, you know, someone who's kind of abusing her or abusing the system, but instead she gave freely because this is to bear the mark of Christ. Luke 6:31, I feel like with this verse we're almost burying the lead here. And he says, as you wish that others would do to you, so do to them. I feel like this verse is the capstone foundational verse of what it means to love our enemies. It's this verse, actually, Luke 6:31, it's a variation of what we commonly call the golden rule, which we find in Leviticus 19:18, where God says, you shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself, for I am the Lord. I am Yahweh. Get those words there. You shall not take vengeance. You shall not bear a grudge. Instead, love. Love your neighbor as yourself. And you'd say, well, who's my neighbor? We'll go to Luke chapter 10 and read the story of the Good Samaritan. And you'll see that the person who is the neighbor is the person who shows mercy. And Jesus says, go and do likewise. Hold on to that thought about mercy. We're going to come back to it. There's this great passage. C.S. Lewis writes in Mere Christianity, and he's talking about the concept of forgiveness. And he talks about this concept of loving our neighbors as ourselves. And he says, we may punish if necessary, as laws allow us to, but we must not enjoy it. In other words, something inside of us, the feeling of resentment, the feeling that wants to get one's own back, must simply be killed. I do not mean that anyone can decide this moment that he will never feel it anymore. That's not how things happen. I mean that every time it bobs its head up, day after day, year after year, all of our lives long, we must hit it on the head. It's hard work, but the attempt is not impossible. Even while we kill and punish, we must try to feel about the enemy as we feel about ourselves, to wish that he were not bad, to hope that he may, in this world or another, be cured, in fact, to wish his good. This is what the Bible means by loving him, wishing his good. It doesn't mean feeling fond of him, nor saying he is nice when he is not. You know, Jesus makes a point then of sort of switching course here. I'm going to kind of go a little more quickly through this, but he takes a different track, right? He came at them head on, right? He said, I want you to love your enemies. I want you to bless those people who curse you. I want you to not try to reclaim things that are taken from you. I don't want you to retaliate when you're threatened. I want you to give freely. And now he's going to come in with sort of a different angle. He's going to come in at them at the side, and he says, if you love those who love you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? For even sinners lend to sinners to get back the same amount. And Jesus, feels pretty straightforward, right? That it's easy to love your friends. That's a generalization because, you know, it's not always easy to love your friends. But in general, your friends are your friends because you have things in common, that you're able to kind of work things out pretty easily. You have good communication between one another. But the type of love that Jesus has just described in verses 27 to 31 will make his followers stand out as distinctive. That the love that we should have for our enemies ought to make us distinctive. Look at the progression here. He talks about love, and then he talks about doing good, and then he gives an example of lending. Love is augmented by doing good, and it's expressed by lending. So think about it. Think about a loan. A loan, by definition, is something that is expected to be repaid. But to loan freely without the expectation of a return is a truly radical idea. And when we do this, when we love our enemies, and when we do good, and when we lend to them expecting nothing in return, then our reward will be great. And when he talks about the reward, it's a nod back to 6:23. He's talking about your reward will be great in heaven. And you will be sons of the Most High. Now, it's not saying that if you do these things, if you love and if you give and all these things, then you're going to be a Christian. It doesn't mean that you're going to earn your sonship by doing these things. It's saying that then you will be shown as a son of God, a son or daughter of God, that you, by your actions, you are going to reflect his behavior. When you reflect his behavior, then you're telling the world that I am a child of God because God is kind to the ungrateful. And God is kind to the evil. Therefore, we should be merciful even as God is merciful. You know, such an idea, this idea of love for our enemies, it's radical stuff. It's counterintuitive. It's counter to what goes on inside of my heart when I'm confronted with with the evils of the world, just in general, or when I'm confronted in my own to my own self, to my own face with the evil that goes out in the world, and it affects me directly. But this call that Jesus has for us to love our enemies, to bless those who curse us, to not retaliate when we're wronged, you know, it should inspire us. Where even the smallest of kindness can have a massive effect. So I want to practical things to just kind of take home. You know, how do you respond to criticism? How do you respond to hurtful words? When people are coming at you, like, what's your first response? Are you generous with your possessions? Are you generous with the things that God has given to you? And when you're wronged, are you... It's okay. No, I've been there. It's all right. I tried to... Sorry, okay. And am I quick to forgive? Like, when I'm wronged, and I will be wronged, because let me tell you, like, I'm going to walk out the door, and I'm immediately going to be the victim of some wrong. When that happens, am I quick to forgive? Am I quick to do what Josh was trying to do? Am I quick to bless? Think of it this way. You have two weapons available to you. You have your mouth, and you have your hands, right? So what are you doing with those things? You know, instead of hurling insults at people, are we blessing? Are we praying for our enemies? And instead of you know, lifting up our fists, are we helping people? You know, do we have an open-handed response to people in this world? I'm gonna finish here, and you know, February is Black History Month, and I want to finish here by quoting. It's a sermon that I've picked up by Martin Luther King Jr. It's a favorite sermon of his that he wrote on loving your enemies, and he was actually preaching out of the Matthew passage, but it was later he revised it and it made its way into a book called Strength to Love. It was published in 1963. So he's speaking about segregation, but I think the notions that he has in here apply very closely to us. And so when speaking of segregation, he says, "To our most bitter opponents, we say that we shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We shall meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we shall continue to love you. We cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws, because non-cooperation with evil is just as much a moral obligation as cooperation with good. Throw us in jail, we shall still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our community at the midnight hour and beat us and leave us half dead, and we shall still love you. But be ye assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer. One day we shall win freedom, but not only for ourselves, we shall also appeal to your heart and conscience, that we shall win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. Love is the most durable power in the world. This creative force, so beautifully exemplified in the life of our Christ, is the most potent instrument available in mankind's quest for peace and security. Jesus is eternally right. History is replete with the bleached bones of nations that refuse to listen to him. May we, in the 20th century, hear and follow his words before it's too late. May we solemnly realize that we shall never be true sons of our Heavenly Father until we love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us." Pray with me. I'm just reminded, God, even this morning, talking with my friends, how easy it is for us to be wounded, even by our closest friends. We know that that you've given us an example, not just an example, but you've given us a command of what it means to love people that don't love back. God, help us to assume a posture of forgiveness, to assume a posture of generosity, that our words would be filled with your grace, that we would be filled with mercy and compassion to everybody in this world, not just our friends, God. I thank you for my friends here. I pray that you would take these words from this broken vessel, God, and that you would just use them to impact us today and this week and in our lives, God. We pray through your Son. Amen.